Welcome to the program for Wednesday, April 4th, 2012 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today in the 3 o'clock hour, as every Wednesday, it is Pentagon Solutions, where we take a deep dive into issues that the Pentagon is dealing with. We hear voices from both inside and outside the Defense Department to talk about potential solutions for the challenges the Defense Department's dealing with. Today, a focus on the Government Accountability Office. Later on in the hour, Mike Sullivan, Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management Issues at GAO, will talk about a report on weaknesses that could jeopardize DOD's 2017 auditability deadline. That is coming up about a half hour from now on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. First, though, happy to welcome back to the program Asif Khan, Director of Financial Management and Assurance Issues, here to talk about weapons programs and what he's finding as he's looking at how they are doing in terms of acquisitions and a number of other issues. And I'm noticing, Asif, that I'm reversing myself, and you're with me to talk about auditability, and I'm happy to have you on the program.
Glad to be here, Francis.
I mentioned before we went on the air that there is a lot going on here and a lot to get into. And I want to ask you, first of all, the focus of your report is on something called the Enterprise Resource Planning Systems that this report says are critical to DOD's auditability goals. What is an ERP, as you call it?
Francis, ERP, simply put, it's a fairly complex automated system. And the key to remember that this is supposed to be off-the-shelf system, that it doesn't require a lot of modification. The other feature about the ERP is that it's supposed to perform multiple functions, and all of these functions are integrated, such as general ledger systems, the accounting function, payroll, supply management. They are all contained in one system. The benefit of this system is that you would only require to enter data once, and then it goes through different processing, whichever program feature or module is needed. So that avoids the repeated data entry, and it can have stronger internal controls, and it's very much suitable for large and complex organizations such as DOD.
I want to come back to the off-the-shelf component, because that's been tricky for a lot of federal agencies. But why are these ERPs so critical to the auditability goal that the Pentagon has?
Goes back to DOD being large and complex. It's got so many different moving pieces. And it's not only auditability. I mean, it's also for improving their financial management. It's also to improve their operations. That is a very important component of these ERPs features, that it's going to give DOD the ability to also improve their operational performance, such as in supply chain, such as acquisition. Now, the point being that a lot of these transactions, in fact, all the transactions, originate somewhere else. They do not originate in financial management. So therefore, having an ERP is very important, so that the transaction which originates in acquisition is input and captured correctly, then goes through the various processing in the different functional area, whether it's DOD or another commercial organization, and then it ends up in financial management, where it's correctly categorized and reported with ease.
Your report says DOD has not done too well with ERP deployment in the past. What have the problems been? I imagine that just the IT implementation of something that may be a customized package might have been part of the problem in the past.
That certainly is a problem, and I guess maybe that's one of the major problems, which leads on to the cost and schedule, which impact the implementation, like scheduling. If they do not have proper schedules, critical path analysis, project management, that's going to delay the schedule, and that's going to impact the cost, how much it's costing, not only to implement the ERPs, but also the cost to keep the legacy systems running. So it becomes very expensive in terms of the financing, the existing systems and financing the newer system, but also it again impacts the operations.
You mentioned something there that I think gets lost in the shuffle a lot of the time when we talk about these transitions, and that is that there is that period of time of overlap where essentially an agency is paying twice for the same function. They can't just stop one with no funds to get the new system up and going and then spend nothing to turn the old one off.
That's very true. And we are finding that in DOD, it's the time period where DOD is having to have multiple systems run at the same time. That's getting extended over and over again, much more beyond what was originally envisaged when these systems or programs were first put into place.
Is that because of the complexity of the programs that are involved, or is there some other factor there?
There are several factors. I mean, complexity is certainly a facet of that. The other one really goes back to scoping of the programs itself to make sure that you're getting the requirements correctly. What the footprint of the ERP or the system is going to be, that has to be laid out correctly. So there are multiple issues which lead to the delay and the increase in cost of implementation of these ERPs.
All right. This report says the GAO was asked to determine issues being encountered by the Army and the Air Force in the implementation of selected ERPs. A couple of questions that come out of that statement. One of them is, I noticed the Navy's not there. Did you get any sense of why you were not asked to look at the Navy?
It all goes back to which of the systems are in each of the services' critical path. For the Army and the Air Force, their ERPs, the ones that have been featured in this report, they're on the critical path to reaching auditability, especially when it was 2017. Though for the Navy ERP is very important for them to be able to reach auditability and sustain auditability, but in their initial cut, the Navy ERP was not an important element to reach auditability by 2017. They were going to reach, they've got several different general ledger systems. They were going to keep their or use the existing or the legacy general ledger systems to be able to reach the first milestone in auditability. That was 2017. So that's why we did not focus on the Navy ERP. We just focused on the ERPs, which were much more critical to reaching that date.
And the phrase at the end of that sentence, the implementation of selected ERPs, implies a couple of things to me. You weren't asked to look at all of them, and there are more than just a few are the two things that I take away from that phrase. Are those correct assumptions on my part?
Yes, Francis, very much so. I mean, this particular report's built on a report that we had issued in 2010. Just for the benefit of the listeners, that's GAO 11-53. In which DOD had identified 10 business systems or ERPs which are critical to their financial management. And so that was a pretty broad brush approach. And then we went in and looked at selected ERPs, just like you had mentioned, which were either there were issues which were perceived in them, or in the case of GFIBS, it was coming up to deployment fairly soon. And as we speak, it's expected to be deployed by the middle of the summer this year.
All right. You mentioned GFEBS, which stands for the Army's General Fund Enterprise Business System. And another one that you write about in this report is DEAMS. That's the Air Force's Defense Enterprise and Accounting Management System. Explain what those are, and then we'll take a break and come back and talk about the significance of what you found about them.
Okay. Both GFIBS and DEAMS are similar in the sense that they are both the general ledger system or for the Army and for Air Force. GFIBS has been, the program has been around since 2002, and same with DEAMS, that has been around for about 10 years. And the expectation was that both of these systems are going to be up and running to be able to enable both the Army and the Air Force to be able to reach auditability, and these systems are going to be supporting the effort to reach auditability.
All right, I'm going to jam one more in before the break then. You said they've been around since 2002. What's the expected life cycle of a system like that?
It varies from both the programs. For instance, the life cycle is going to mean that, when these systems are going to need replacement.
Yes.
I've got the information for GFIBS in front of me. I mean, the GFIBS is expected to go on till 2022.
Okay, so I'm just wanted a kind of a sense, not specific numbers, just a sense of how far along we might be in this life cycle, and we're still not necessarily at the point that we'd like to be. And from that number, it sounds to me like we're halfway through the life cycle of the system already.
Correct. And I mean, to be fair, the life cycle does include the conceptualization of the program, the planning of the program itself, the development, and then obviously the fielding of it, and then the actual deployment, and then running and operation and maintenance. That's about half of the program life cycle.
My guest is Asif Khan. He is Director of Financial Management and Assurance Issues at the Government Accountability Office. We're talking about auditability at the Department of Defense on Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Our conversation continues in a moment. And a reminder, you can read the report that we're talking about linked up later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We'll be right back.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract Series 83500.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Are you ready for the federal telework and workforce mobility initiatives? Hi, I'm Amy Rock with the federal sector of VCE. VBlock infrastructure platforms with VMware View provide a fast, proven path to desktop virtualization. Industry-leading security ensures that your employees can safely access information whenever, wherever, on whatever device they're using, from laptops to smartphones. By integrating technologies from Cisco, EMC, and VMware, VCE delivers high availability, exceptional performance, and almost unlimited scalability in a world-class converged infrastructure, so you can ensure your employees remain connected and productive in the face of bad weather, disasters, or just their kid's soccer game.
Federal telework and workforce mobility are changing the way people work. VCE can speed implementation, providing everything you need to reap the rewards of improved productivity and better retention, while staying on top of ever-increasing cost, compliance, and performance demands. To learn more, visit vce.com/federal.
I have this dream where I'm the head of an army of cybersecurity engineers fighting cyber terrorists around the world. My strategies lead to real-world applications that are shutting down black hats and bringing them to justice. Government agencies and multinational corporations are seeking me out to... Hang on. This isn't some fantasy. This is exactly what my doctorate in information assurance from Capital College is preparing me for.
The online Doctor of Science degree in Information Assurance at Capital gives you absolute validation as an authority on cybersecurity and safeguarding information assets. Capital College is recognized as a national center of academic excellence in information assurance education by the NSA and DHS.
My dream is becoming a reality because of Capital College. It isn't for everyone, but it's perfect for me.
For a virtual info session on graduate programs at Capital College, visit capital-college.edu/radio. That's capital with an O, -college.edu/radio.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Thursday's Federal Drive. When career employees flout laws and regulations, say in planning a conference, they can lose their jobs. But is that it? Find out in our Legal Loop interview. Plus, bring your own device to work, good or bad. One large corporation has half its employees bring their own devices, and it works out just fine. Those stories and more tomorrow morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's Pentagon Solutions in the 3 o'clock hour every Wednesday when we look at issues the Pentagon's dealing with and talk about potential solutions with people both inside and outside of the Department of Defense. My guest today is Asif Khan. He's Director of Financial Management and Assurance Issues at the Government Accountability Office. He's been looking at some situations that could jeopardize DOD's auditability goals. His report is linked now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And Asif, we talked about the systems that the Army calls the General Fund Enterprise Business System and the Air Force's Defense Enterprise and Accounting Management System. You told me these are their, essentially, their general ledger system. systems. And you did some assessments on these and reviewed some assessments by independent agencies. Talk about what folks found when these systems went under the microscope.
Right. I mean, like I'd mentioned, I mean, both these are the general ledger system. We talked to there were two pieces to our report. One was relying on the work that was done by the Army and Air Force's Test and Evaluation Command. They had done some work on both these systems going back a few years ago, and we thought their work was very valuable in terms of highlighting some of the deficiencies these systems had and to get an update on to the progress, how the issues were being resolved. And the other one was to speak with the user community, and these systems, both these systems, are being used pretty heavily by DFAS, the Defense Finance and Accounting Service, in Indianapolis and in Cleveland. And what they had mentioned was that because of some of the features the systems, both GFIBS and DEAMS, did not have, it was requiring them a fair amount of workaround, which was going to be pretty intensive, and much more than that, that it's going to be unsustainable once these systems got fully implemented. One of the examples that I can give you of the issues that DFAS highlighted was that almost two-thirds of the invoices and receipt data that DFAS had to process had to be manually entered into GFIBS. This is not only labor-intensive, but it's also time-consuming, and it can also lead to a lot of errors. Similarly, with DEAMS, the issue was that DEAMS could not provide monthly account receivable aging reports as they were designed to produce. And that was something which the users feels that they really needed for to be able to do their jobs.
What was the cause of this? Was this interfacing with other financial management systems across the agencies, or was this, were these deficiencies within this piece of IT itself, or with each of these individually, or was there some combination of issues?
Right. I mean, the immediate answer was it was an interface issue, but that is going to be an issue which is going to be faced DoD-wide, because you are you're implementing a system which you're implementing a system in an environment in which there are over 2,000 systems. Whether they're financial systems or logistics systems, but the general ledger has to rely on those systems to pull the information to be able to report them. So the immediate issue was interface, because the data from the older systems could not be communicated to the new system. So it was not producing the desired results when they went back to test to see whatever information was input, has that actually been received by the new system, and if it's been processed the way it should have been. They were finding there were a lot of gaps in it. So that's why the DFAS users had to enter this information manually.
You mentioned in both of these examples in the report, Asif, that there is no timetable, no timeline for solving these problems. Did you get a sense that that was because the respective forces didn't know when they would be able to, or didn't know how they would be able to?
Yeah, just to clarify, they had a timeline. The timeline was broken down more by the tasks which had to be done to be able to overcome this problem. However, they did not define exactly when each of those tasks is going to be accomplished. So, both the Army and Air Force are aware of the deficiencies. It's just that they did not put a time frame when each of the different deficiencies is going to be resolved and rectified. And also, I mean, I think there may be a communication issue in it, that the actual users were not kind of forthcoming in terms of highlighting the deficiencies in the systems to both the Army and Air Force.
So they have a list of steps that they intend to take to fix the problems, just haven't been able to attach a calendar to it yet.
Correct.
Is that fair to say?
That's exactly what I meant.
There's a training piece of this that unfortunately we're not going to have time to talk about, but because we focus on training from time to time, that's important. And I would encourage anybody to go to federalnewsradio.com/in-depth and look at this report. We have it linked up there. You make recommendations to the Defense Department on this. There are five of them. Talk about those briefly, please, Asif.
Our key recommendation was, we're looking at oversight. We're looking at the controls in place to make sure that these programs are reaching the desired intention. So we are placing a fair amount of credibility to the milestone decision authority, and that's where our first recommendation was that the milestone decision authority make sure is providing the adequate level of scrutiny so that these programs do not move forward until all the key issues are resolved. The other two recommendations for each of the other two systems really focused on defining a time frame to the known issues. Altogether five recommendations. Two of these were for the Air Force and two for the Army. And then the fourth and fifth recommendation was on training. Just that you'd mentioned that, I mean, the users were getting training on the concept of the system, but they were not really being told how to do their job in the new systems environment. DoD concurred with all our recommendations. However, they did make a comment on the milestone decision authority role that they are going to be prioritizing all the deficiencies that have been noted, whether by GAO or by other third-party evaluators, and then based on the showstoppers, those are the issues they're going to resolve, and then some of the other issues which are of a lower priority, they're going to address them as and when they're needed to. And we are fine as long as their prioritization, as long as there is adequate oversight and due diligence done so that these programs are not moving ahead without reaching the desired intention, we are fine with that.
This is a tremendous challenge for the Pentagon to deal with, Asif, and I appreciate you being on to talk about it with me this afternoon. Thanks for your time.
Glad to be here, Francis. Thank you.
Asif Khan is Director of Financial Management and Assurance Issues at the Government Accountability Office. You can read his report linked up on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and his colleague Mike Sullivan will be my guest when In-Depth with Francis Rose continues. Next on Pentagon Solutions, weapons programs at the Department of Defense, the acquisition process for them, and how it looks next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Facing a new day, delivering services efficiently, improving citizens' lives, Booz Allen Hamilton supports the most important challenges of government, from defense and economic security to health and cyber solutions. Booz Allen strategy and technology consultants partner with clients to deliver results that endure. Whether managing today's issues or looking beyond the horizon, clients can count on Booz Allen to help them be ready for what's next. BoozAllen.com/ready for what's next.
You know, choosing how you listen to radio is important. If you don't visit HDRadio.com, you won't learn about the new local HD2, HD3 radio stations. If you don't hear the new local HD2, HD3 stations, you won't hear everything you should. If you don't hear everything you should, you won't understand what your friends are talking about. To understand what your friends are talking about, visit HDRadio.com to learn about HD radio receivers like the Pioneer DEH44HD, now only $120 at Walmart.
When lives are at stake, you need technology you can count on. FLIR Systems' legacy of life-saving thermal imaging sensors continues through their offering of full-spectrum chemical, biological, radiation, and explosive threat detection systems and beyond-the-fence perimeter security solutions. Visit FLIR.com to learn more. FLIR Systems, because it's not just your job, it's your life.
This is Lisa Millman from AFMA. For over 133 years, we've proudly served the U.S. Armed Forces community with low-cost life insurance and unique survivor assistance services. We always focus on our members' best interests. That means offering the best prices on life insurance for all military personnel and policies with no war or aviation clauses. Get a free life insurance quote today at AFMA.com. That's AAFMAA.com.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Raw milk. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfus with HHS HealthBeat. Raw milk has its following, but experts say the followers are putting themselves at risk, and their children and families, too. Raw milk is non-pasteurized, which means it has not been treated against germs that can be found in cows, even if the cow looks healthy. Some people think raw milk is better, but researcher Adam Langer of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention knows what happens to people who drink it.
Raw milk and other non-pasteurized dairy products can carry harmful bacteria and other germs that can make you very sick or kill you.
He says some raw milk drinkers have wound up needing weeks of kidney dialysis and even ventilators to help them breathe. The study is in the CDC journal Emerging Infectious Diseases. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Federal News Radio United Way Community Spotlight for April is Montgomery Hospice. For more than 30 years, Montgomery Hospice has provided expert end-of-life medical care for residents of Montgomery County who are living with an advanced illness. Patients receive care in their own homes from compassionate professionals who provide dignity and peace. The patients' families receive support as well. For more information, visit federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Radio charities are fed by Papa John's.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and our focus on the Government Accountability Office continues on Pentagon Solutions today. Every Wednesday in the 3 o'clock hour, we look at issues that the Pentagon is dealing with, and we talk to people both inside and outside the Defense Department to get some perspective on how the Pentagon might deal with those challenges and find some solutions. My guest for this part of the program is Mike Sullivan, Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management Issues at the Government Accountability Office. His report looks at the defense acquisitions issue and is titled Assessments of Selected Weapons Programs. Mike, it's good to have you back on the program. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Let's start with the acquisition system overall. This report notes that it's on the GAO's high-risk list. Why is that?
The high-risk list is the Congress and the Department of Defense have, for a very long time, since the late 70s, I would say, have explored ways to improve the acquisition of major weapon systems, but they've pretty much continually had poor outcomes, which means that there's been significant cost growth on the major weapon systems, and they've had schedule delays, and they don't always get what was promised once the weapon system is delivered. It's a very difficult process, of course. You know, the national security is a high-risk area to begin with. The portfolio that they're talking about is over $1 trillion. In fact, it's close it's over $1.5 trillion, actually. So that in and of itself is inherently kind of high risk for us. The weapon systems have been on our high risk list since it began quite a while ago.
So you've got three main points in this report that you are to look at as a result of the 2009 DOD Appropriations Act. Outline each of those three points that you examined, please.
Okay, you're referring to the Acquisition Reform Act. That was an authorization act in 2009 done by the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Yes.
And so we kind of check ever since 2009, we've been checking the department in this report as to how well it's responding to the act and what was implemented. So we had three observations we made this year. The first one was that almost all of the future major defense acquisition programs that we assessed have implemented or plan to implement acquisition reforms from the WSARA Act, the Weapons Systems Acquisition Reform Act. From 2009. Now, that's future programs. We looked at 16 of those. The current programs have a more mixed record in regards to implementing the requirements of the act, and most of that is because they were already in place, and it's more difficult for them to do that. The second thing we found is that some of these 16 future programs that we talk about have not implemented some of DOD's new policy requirements in areas like there was a new material development decision that DOD had formed, which would kick off any new program with a hard look from the top decision makers. many future and current programs are still working to implement those new initiatives. They are relatively new. They were issued in late 2010, so we're giving them more time to do that. Some of the things are affordability targets and new should-cost analysis that the department wanted them to do. And then the third observation was the 16 future programs that we assessed are beginning to invest. It looks to us like they're investing more funds up front, which we find to be a good thing when appropriate. In other words, they're investing money in developing the proper technologies and doing the proper design reviews before they actually initiate the program. You know, that can be a positive outcome of this because you spend money up front to save money later on.
Let me go back to the comment that you made about the $1.58 trillion in this portfolio of major defense acquisition programs. This report says in the past year, the total acquisition cost for these programs has grown by over $74.4 billion, or 5%. Now, you break that out into three separate areas. Define those three areas and what they mean, please, Mike.
Okay. The portfolio from last year to this grew by about 5%. It grew from about $1.5 trillion to $1.578 trillion. It was about a $74 billion increase. And to break that out, about 4% of that, or $14 billion, was development cost growth. That comes out of the research, development, test, and evaluation budget. That's kind of non-recurring costs just to develop and design the product. $61 billion came out of the procurement cost, which is basically just the purchase of the end item. So the procurement cost, the ability to buy the aircraft, went up by 61%, which was a 5% increase for that. That's how you get the $74 billion total estimated cost growth from one year to the next.
Now, the pie chart that you have in this report says $31.1 billion of that was from procurement cost growth due to inefficiencies and other factors,
yeah.
$29.6 billion because of quantity changes.
Yeah.
Talk about the quantity changes and the impact that that has throughout the life of a particular system.
Yes, that's something, in fact, that the department is very sensitive about, and we have become sensitive to it as well, because when you look at if you look at procurement costs growing overall at about $61 billion, the department argues, and I guess we have taken into consideration the fact that $30 billion of that generally comes from changes in quantities, which means they've increased the quantities that they're going to buy of some of these weapon systems. And that can be a good thing because they're getting good value out of those. So we look at that as cost growth that has much more positive nature to it, as opposed to the $31 billion. When you divide that out and you're left with $31 billion of procurement cost growth that is just the result of having risks spill over from development program and just inefficiencies on the manufacturing floor.
Mike, you use a term in this report that I want you to define when we come back from the break. That term is buying power, and I'd like you to tell me more about that when we continue on Pentagon Solutions on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This is In Depth with Francis Rose. My guest is Mike Sullivan of the Government Accountability Office. We'll continue in a moment.
How will you meet the fast-approaching deadline for federal data center consolidation? Hi, I'm Amy Rock with the federal sector of VCE. One thing is certain. Traditional IT approaches won't work. With industry-leading technology from Cisco, EMC, and VMware, VCE VBlock infrastructure platforms require far less floor space, power, and cooling, lowering your facility's costs by 30% or more compared to traditional data centers. You get the performance, security, and scalability needed for mission-critical applications, together with simplified management solutions for a virtualized environment. And because every platform is integrated and tested before it ships, you can move VBlock platforms into production within days, not weeks or months.
Only VCE provides a converged infrastructure platform that's designed specifically for virtualized environments. And it's pre-configured and fully validated before it arrives on your data center floor. It's the winning proposition for fast, efficient data center consolidation. To learn more, visit VCE.com/federal.
Federal pay and benefits are taking center stage in the 2013 budget debate. President Obama has proposed a 0.5% pay increase for feds, while Republicans are calling for a federal pay freeze through 2015. Republicans also support a 10% cut to the size of the federal workforce, while both plans promote an increase in feds' contributions to their retirement accounts. FederalNewsRadio.com is your home for all of the latest budget news. Visit FederalNewsRadio.com, search term budget.
Nominations for the third annual Causey Award are now being accepted. If you're wondering who could be nominated, check out our past winners. 2010, IRS's Beverly Malone created a mentoring program for wounded soldiers to gain work experience with the IRS prior to transitioning out of military service. Nominate someone in your office who you think has made a difference helping people change their career path. Don't delay. Nominations for the third annual Causey Awards close Friday, April 6th. Go to federalnewsradio.com, search Causey Award.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Pentagon Solutions today includes a focus on the Government Accountability Office, and my guest for this portion of the program is Mike Sullivan, Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management Issues at the GAO. His report is called Defense Acquisitions, Assessments of Selected Weapon Programs, and we're talking about a number of issues revolving the acquisition of those weapon programs. Mike, I mentioned before the break that this report includes this passage. The majority of programs in the portfolio, that's referring to the portfolio of 96 major defense acquisition programs that you valued at $1.58 trillion. Your report says that this portfolio, majority of the programs, have lost buying power. What does the phrase buying power mean, and how do you lose it?
Well, when we speak of buying power, we usually are looking at the unit cost, the end items, what the end items are going to cost when the unit cost for each end item in terms of program unit costs goes up. It generally means that's a loss of buying power because it means something else has to give. Either you have to get that money from another program or you have to reduce the quantities of that particular weapon system that you're going to buy. So the amount of money that you had planned to spend could be the same amount of money, but you're going to get less for it because each one is going to cost more. So in this report, we looked at, I think of the 96 programs we looked at, 61 are going to have their program acquisition unit costs go up year over year, which means they're going to miss that money. Only 11 of those actually had quantity decreases. When you decrease quantities, your unit cost goes up almost as a, you know, if you just do the math, mm-hmm. less quantities. All of the others, about 50 cases, I think 50 or 51 cases, the unit costs went up for other reasons, which means it was either inefficiencies in the production process or maybe cost growth on the development side.
Is that always a corollary? Is there? Can you graph it, or does it vary depending on the programs, the connection between the quantity changes and the cost growth?
You can kind of correlate it when you're talking about quantity changes. I mean, you know, if there's a when we want to look at the effect of quantity decreases, you can do the math because that's kind of a derivative. You know, you're dividing the total procurement. If you have $100 billion in procurement costs and you're buying 10, you can do that math. If that cost goes up, or if you're not allowed to spend that much money anymore, obviously the unit costs will go up. If you're talking about quantities being reduced or increased, I think there's kind of a better correlation. Then when you don't have any changes in quantities and the cost goes up, that's something else is going on in the program.
You mentioned earlier that there were three main points that you looked at in this. The cost growth is one point. Another one that you have here is, you write, GAO's reported that newer programs are demonstrating higher levels of knowledge at key decision points. However, most of the 37 programs GAO assessed this year are still not fully adhering to a knowledge-based acquisition approach. Tell me what that means.
Okay, well, the knowledge-based acquisition approach is something that we have developed over years of actually looking at best practices and looking at product development both within the department, across the government, and really we've gone out to a lot of world-class companies in the private sector to learn more about technology development and product development. So in a nutshell, we kind of came back and figured out that one of the basic things that has to happen when you're developing a product is you have to reduce risk. Knowledge really is the thing that supplants risk over time on a program. So in examining weapon acquisitions and best practices, specifically in the area of product development, we found that a lot of successful programs pursue an acquisition approach that's anchored in knowledge of technologies and then design knowledge a little bit after that, and then, of course, manufacturing or production knowledge as you're getting ready to produce. So a good program will center its beginning around a business case that has knowledge about the technologies that are going to be needed. You want mature technologies. You want to understand the funding that you have available. You have to have your priorities right in terms of this program is going to get the proper attention. You have to have the right people. Technology is a key there. So we call that knowledge point one, and that means that your technology risk should be retired. And then you still have risk moving forward. As you begin the program, you start opening up the factories and starting to get your processes in place. You have to make sure the design is stable. So you have integration and design risk, and the best companies and the best programs in DOD that we found generally drove towards a prototype, an engineering prototype at about midway through product development, which would be proven at a critical design review. Engineering drawings based on that prototype and some testing that has taken place, and then you consider the integration or the design risk retired at that point with the knowledge that you've gained from prototyping and drawing, making engineering drawings. Once you've issued those drawings, there's one more risk remaining, and that's your ability to manufacture a high-quality product with the manufacturing processes that you have. So product development the rest of the time is spent trying to demonstrate that you can build the product on the manufacturing processes that you need at the rate that you need to build them. So that is manufacturing or production risk that has to be retired at that point. So we've developed criteria from our best practices work, and we've applied it to DOD when we do this what we're doing with the 37 programs, the subset that we looked at here. We apply those knowledge points to each one of those programs.
Did you get a sense of the ones that you that weren't following this knowledge-based acquisition process? Did you get a sense of why they weren't doing it?
For the most part, there are a lot of reasons, I think, why they're not doing it. Some of them are cultural in nature and very hard to nail down. Some of them are just that they may have missed some things. But essentially, I think, when you look at what the Department of Defense does in building weapon systems, you are in a high-risk environment to begin with. So it's a very high-performance-oriented environment. In the past, it has been not so much emphasis on gaining the knowledge you need and worrying too much about cost. It's been more about, you know, we need an F-22 fighter that's invisible to our enemy, can go faster than anything else, has more range, fused avionics and all of that. I mean, it was always pushing the envelope. So these programs have always been high risk. It hasn't been until more recently when we've really, you know, seen budget constraints really come down hard that the department is beginning to understand that you can't necessarily operate that way. You have to you know, you can't take a program to a production line when you're still trying to invent the technologies that are needed. Usually what that results in is a rush to failure.
And this is what we're seeing, I imagine, in the F-35 program when we hear people at the Pentagon talking about concurrence, and it sounds like they're not as pleased with concurrence now that they're in the middle of it as I guess they were when they decided to go ahead in that direction. Am I on the right track there?
Yes, you are. And in fact, I was going to say when we were talking about the portfolio stuff, when you look at the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35 program, today, that $75 billion of cost growth that we were talking about for the overall portfolio, about $38 billion of that, or over half of the cost growth, was from this one program. And the Joint Strike Fighter program is a classic case of what I was just discussing. It's driven by requirements that are too tough to achieve, technologies that aren't mature. You know, to meet those requirements, you have to push technologies that aren't really mature yet. And that is a recipe for disaster on any program. I will say that over the past 5 years, or since the Reform Act we discussed and some of the things that the department has been trying to implement in its own policies, we have seen a trend towards less of that, trying to get requirements that are more doable at the outset, more incremental, knowledge-based kind of acquisitions.
Mike Sullivan's Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management Issues at the Government Accountability Office, talking about his report on assessing selected weapon programs. And you use one more term in here that I'd like you to define for me when we come back from the break, Mike. That's the term should cost, and we'll discuss that when in-depth with Francis Rose continues. Pentagon Solutions wrapping up in a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hey everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
We hope you have a happy Easter next Sunday, April 8th, and we'll be playing a best of. It's our first live remote at Carmine's. We were joined by Michelle Richard, Jeff Black, Scott Trunow, and Joe Nathan. You'll get to hear all about it.
That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday at 11, right here on 1500 AM.
For a professional master's degree that will take your career to the next level, the University of Maryland's Master's in Applied Economics can help you gain a valuable professional advantage and expand your career opportunities. Meet faculty and get all your questions answered at the next information session, April 18th at 6:30 p.m. in the Ronald Reagan Building at the Federal Triangle Metro Stop. More details and directions at masters.econ.umd.edu.
Registration's now open for the all-new ACT-IAC Management of Change Conference, featuring interactive sessions around cloud, mobility, and security, and a future technology expo, June 3rd through 5th at the Hyatt Regency, Cambridge, Maryland. This government industry training forum is hosted by the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council. Register and learn more at actgov.org/managementofchange. That's actgov.org/managementofchange.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Wrapping up today's Pentagon Solutions, my conversation with Mike Sullivan, Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management Issues at the Government Accountability Office. His report, called Defense Acquisitions Assessments of Selected Weapon Programs, is linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. You can read it there anytime you want. One more sentence I want to ask you about, Mike. You write, programs have started to implement new DOD initiatives such as developing affordability targets and conducting should-cost analysis. Affordability targets is pretty self-explanatory, I think. Explain the concept of a should-cost analysis, please.
Yeah, so this is in I think I was talking about a memo that was put out late in 2010 that was the Better Buying Initiative is what it was called, and it was put out by the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisitions. That's the major decision maker for all of these programs we're talking about. And in essence, they, you know, in addition to the affordability target, in other words, affordability should become a requirement just like all of the capabilities on a weapon system. That was one thing they did to elevate cost in everyone's minds. The other one was what they call should-cost management, and they asked all of the program managers on each one of these programs and their contracting officers in addition to their industry counterparts, they are now trying to require each of those managers to do what they call a should-cost analysis that justifies each element of the program's cost and showing how it is improving year by year or meeting other relevant benchmarks for value. So in other words, it really is, if you think about lean engineering or the lean management that you hear about a lot, it's asking the program managers along with their contracting officers and their counterparts that are building the product to go in and look at each element, break it out by element, by subsystem, by category, function across the program, and see if there isn't any more cost that they can wring out of the program. They've implemented it. I think they used it to a great deal on the Joint Strike Fighter recently. I know that sounds kind of ironic since they've had such cost growth, but Joint Strike Fighter in the past two or three years has gone through an incredible rebaselining, and they brought should cost in on that. It's just a way to drive towards more efficiency.
We have just about a minute or so left, Mike. Can you tell me what the response was from the Department of Defense to this work that you've done?
The Department of Defense, it's here. We've been doing this for 10 or 11 years now. The department is not always happy with the way the information gets depicted, but in general they agree with the formatting that we have and the numbers that we have. They agree with our facts. And I think that the department, in fact, we've done a lot of work with the department to try to make this a better product, and I think it's beginning to show up. This year, I think they were relatively happy. One of the things that they really objected to in the past was this idea of cost increases that happen when quantities go up. And as you can see, we've tried to break that out and address it so that everybody understands that not all cost increases are necessarily bad. Sometimes it means you're getting more of a good product. So in general, I think the department is willing to work with us on this. They understand where we're coming from. And, I'd say year to year, we always have our we sit down every year and talk about this, and we kind of get our complaints out on the table. But basically, they understand where we're coming from.
Mike, that's where we have to leave it today. I'm grateful for your time. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Okay, thank you.